There were two things I wanted to follow up on from the last episode. I forgot to do either of them.
Sure.
Does smell and taste...
Oh, yeah, you wanted
go
to...
Go to the same center of brain.
Mm-hmm.
And the other thing I forgot. We're going to sit here and wait a moment and see if she responds right away.
No, let's just keep going.
No, because I don't want to forget about this.
I would...
All right. We'll come back to this. We'll leave it as a cliffhanger, and we'll see if she gets back to me in a timely fashion and if I remember.
Yes.
All right, let's go. Let's go. Do it.
Welcome, Start. Everyone. Welcome to You're Gonna Need a Bigger Bottle.
Welcome.
It's a podcast about movies and wine. And for those of you who don't know shit about one or the other topic, my name is Jamie Harrison Rubin, the third Esquire. And I'm the wine guy.
He's Jamie. I'm Scott. I'm your movie guy. And we are here to help you, dear listener. Each episode, we pair a movie or movies that I love with a wine or, no, still just wine singular that he loves.
We tell you why we like them, how they're made, and why they work. Hopefully, we find a pairing that works. Usually, we do not. Today is the final episode of our mini-series.
Parental guidance. Suggested. Parental guidance.
Suggested?
Suggested.
You suggested perhaps an interrobang.
That's right, because last time was suggestions with the ellipsis. Parental guidance. Suggested! Ooh, that was a weird crack in my voice.
That was also terrible. Loud. That hurt my ears a little bit.
Oh, I'm glad.
Ouchie.
There's a little flashback to RRR the other night. as those of you who have been playing along should know, my now 6-year-old son and I watch an awful lot of movies together, and I know that's something that a lot of parents struggle to get their kids to do, either because the kids like to watch the same goddamn thing over and over and over and over again.
And over and over and over and over.
And over and over. Or because, you know, it's the flying carless future that we're all living in where it's tick and it's talk and it's social and it's streaming and it's video games and Minecraft and whatever the hell Roblox is. I'm sure I'm going to have to get invested in knowing about Roblox soon.
What the fuck is a Roblox?
It's a thing that the small children like, and I think it's like a Transformer and a video game and maybe a Pokemon card all in one. I don't really know.
Okay.
I'm fine not knowing. I don't have to yet.
But eventually you will.
Eventually I will. But for all those parents out there who can't get their kids to watch movies or who want something new for their kids to watch, I'm making some suggestions. These are titles that have been in the regular rotation in my household with my son and stuff that I think that you and your kids might enjoy. I don't want to say gone out of my way, but I have been negligent in providing any kind of like age indication whatsoever here.
Yep.
My son is now 6. Many of these movies you might think are too old for a 6-year-old or even for a child, however the hell your child's age is. I don't know, man. Like, listen in, context clues, you figure it out. Every parent makes every judgment. Every family's different. That's what I have to tell my child when I explain why he's the only kid at his private kindergarten who wears a mask. Every family makes their own decisions because that's the libertarian hellscape that we live in.
I have no comment.
Also, if you don't like these movies, Jamie's will recommend wines. That was the last thing I had to say. Aside from my political digression.
Yes, indeed.
There's also wine.
On the wine side, we're talking about Spanish wine for this miniseries. I very much wanted to give myself an excuse to study a little bit more about Spain and learn more about Spanish wine, and it's been a joy so far. I wanted to give you some wines that would be perhaps a little bit more in the background, allowing you to not focus so much on what's in your glass so you could enjoy the film and also parent a probably rambunctious young child. And I also wanted these wines to be appropriate to pair with simple, child-friendly food for those of you who have kids that are not particularly adventurous eaters.
This is a real stretch for you. I haven't given you credit for this yet. In part because it's not in my nature to give you credit for things.
We know this.
Right. For you to pick wines that you are advocating that people not pay attention to all of the fruity, floofy, nonsensical, psalm bullshit that you obsess over, where you're just like, it's just a thing in a glass and you don't have to pay attention to it. And that's what I want you to do. That feels like that goes against, you know, some core fundamental thing to your being. And I think I'm impressed. That wasn't a compliment, but I do think I'm impressed that you've stretched. You've stretched and you're doing something that is accommodating to people who don't care about wine the way that you do.
Yes. You would see this more in my like everyday character if it weren't you. I don't accommodate you, Scott Hudson, but I do accommodate other people in my day-to-day life.
Speaking of not accommodating me, I'm going to have a sniff of the wine here. I'm not going to drink it yet. We're going to hold off, but I'm going to have a sniff of the wine first and see if Jamie...
Have a little sniffer.
...actually like managed to end the miniseries with two wines in a row that I don't find repulsive.
I'm really hoping you like this wine.
Jamie, it smells like sherry. It smells like fucking sherry. So, for the previous six episodes, for most of the previous six episodes, we have done double features here. Two movies to watch with your kids and to gamify things on the pairing end, which we oftentimes forget to even talk about on this show. The pairings have become increasingly conceptual and esoteric and theoretical and aren't actually about what's in the glass.
I mean, they started esoteric and theoretical.
Well, it's because you don't know how to do your job, Jamie.
No, it's because that's what I care about and you just want to complain about it the whole time.
I just want to talk about pairings of movies.
Blah, blah, blah. My name is Scott and this is what I sound like.
Anyway, Jamie had to pick one bottle to pair with one, both, or neither of the movies in here. And we're going to find out at the end of the episode or fucking whatever if he actually did it this time.
Yep.
So far, let's see if I recall correctly. No, I don't recall correctly. Let me bring up the spreadsheet. We need to look at the spreadsheet, everybody.
We love a good spreadsheet.
This is a good one, too. It's pretty good. It could be better. I believe for the first episode, Teen Titans Go and Steven Universe, we said you were one out of two there.
Yes, correct.
Babe 2 and Happy Feet 2, I believe we concurred you were one out of two that it paired with Babe 2, but not Happy Feet.
Yep, and went a step further to say that the Partida Creuse also paired with Teen Titans Go.
Right. I did throw you that one. Yep. But that's you're two for four so far. Third episode, A Town Called Panic, Wallace and Gromit. I think you thought that the 1984 paired with
Wallace and Gromit, but not with Town Called Panic.
And I didn't think it paired with either. I thought it paired with Babe, and I did some musical chairs bullshit to throw you a win and say that the Partida Creuse SP actually would go nicely with the insanity of a town called Panic.
And I think that that's true.
So let's say third episode in, you're three for six.
Right.
Then we had some fundies and we did a triple feature, the three Miyazaki films, Totoro, Kiki, and man, the spreadsheet, it says Ponyo here. I was really indecisive on that one. Yes, I Spirited Away. I
maintained that it paired well with Totoro, though you disagreed.
Right, I think you're dumb.
But we both agree that it pairs well with Spirited Away.
Right, even though I didn't like the wine.
Because you're dumb. Because that wine is delicious.
Or weird and gross. So you're out of, hang on, I'm doing math. That would take us to nine. So out of nine, we agreed that you got four. So you're four out of nine. Last week's episode, The Kid and Sherlock Jr., well, I don't think it really paired with either. That was a goose egg.
Yep.
So you're 9 out of 11.
Wait, what?
Four out of 11. And now today we have this Colt 45, not Colt 45, Kota 45.
Kota 45.
With Paddington and Dora. Oh, I didn't even say the names of the movies yet. All right. So I don't even know what the stakes are here, Jamie. Like you can't.
There aren't any stakes.
If this pairs with both, you'll be at 6 out of 13 movies, which is still an F.
That's
still
correct,
less than 50%.
What I think you're doing here that is wrong is absolving yourself of any responsibility.
Okay, well, I described the things and you had to pair to them.
Yeah.
So,
well, some of those descriptions I disputed. And also,
more than the ones that you disputed, many of them you just outright ignored.
There was also some of that.
There was quite a bit of that. Anyway, with the stakes being nothing, we will now find out how well Jamie can do the pairing portion of whatever. Today, we are talking about 2017's Paddington 2, a beautiful, perfect, simple, humanistic fable about a sweet, innocent refugee bear who goes to prison and discovers that, you know what? Prisoners are human beings too.
Yep.
And a 2019 film that I had no expectation would be worth a goddamn at all. And it turns out is lovely and terrific and quite sweet and pretty well made. And that would be 2019's Dora and the Lost City of Gold.
Those were fun. It was a good viewing experience.
I am glad. Now, Jamie, you called me out at the end of last episode, which no one will ever hear because I'm cutting fuck out of it. Because you only get to call me out once for this stuff. Because
you're a jerk.
But
well, I'm not calling you out this time. This time you are copping to it.
Well, now I'm copping to it before you can call me out.
Okay. You're getting ahead of it.
So I told you that these two movies were floral, whimsical, progressive, elegant, and extremely British.
Yep.
Now, I imagine anyone listening to this with even the most basic understanding of popular culture will understand that only one of these movies is extremely British. You made this pairing based on Paddington and TBD title.
Yep.
Because I struggled mightily to pick a final thing. Not that I struggled to pair something to go with Paddington.
No, you struggled to pick anything.
Well, I struggled specifically.
You were going to do Paddington and Paddington 2.
It was originally going to be Paddington and Paddington 2. And then so as we discussed weeks ago, the initial impetus for the episode was fuck the mouse, fuck their inspiring content. I hate them. And I hate them for thinking that like, oh, we're Disney. We're going to do some like superficially progressive things. And therefore that absolves us from like, you know, giving money to shitty Florida Republicans who want to ban gay children.
Yep.
And then the whole, we've already gone into it.
Scott's just getting himself angry. I can see the steam rising from his head.
It's just, you know, that like a bunch of fascists who tried to storm the Capitol a few months ago are now all of a sudden mad that like Disney has the temerity to like turn off the fucking faucet of money going to their friends just because there was a public outcry because the family film company probably shouldn't be giving money to people who want to legislate against children.
Yep, correct.
But I digress.
And you also hate defending Disney.
I really, really do. But Dora was a last minute pick for this episode. It was actually suggested by Tani the other day because she was tired of me like being wishy-washy and indecisive about it. Because I was trying to find something that's family friendly for the whole miniseries in general, but like looking at my list when I got to the end of it, I realized that I picked a lot of things that were like made by or about white men or just white people in general.
Yep.
And that's a problem in the American film industry in general. It's a problem in family films, which are largely dominated by animated movies. And animation is overwhelmingly dominated by white men in the director's chair. And I have to say it, the one fucking company that's like been genuinely good about it in recent years has been the goddamn Walt Disney Corporation, who has made an effort to center non-white characters and stories and cultures in a lot more of their animated fare. And they occasionally even put non-white people and women in the director's chair. Very occasionally. Oftentimes they fire them anyway. But I must give them credit. I must give them credit.
And Give them that credit.
That is all. I've done it. I've given them credit. One could argue that a lot of those progressive efforts have been superficial and performative on the Mouse House's part. But I cannot and will not argue with the impact and the like genuinely refreshing variety of some of the things that they've put out. That said, I still don't want to pick Disney movies, and no one needs me to recommend like Moana or Encanto to you.
Or even Turning Red.
Or Turning Red. So after weeks of like agonizing over this and trying, and I watched a bunch of other things, a bunch of animated films from countries around the world, a bunch of which were directed by women, and a lot of them were artistically great, and they just either weren't right for my kid or they weren't right for the miniseries. One of them, one of like the best movies I've seen this year is called Kirikou and the Sorceress, and it's this beautiful 1990s animated film, but it's like, it never really got U.S. distribution because the little boy runs around naked with his like wiener hanging out all the time. And all the women are like, it's a rural traditional African community. So like a lot of the female characters are bare breasted, but it's not sexualized in any kind of way. And it's this like amazing adventure fable and it's great. And honestly, the only reason that I didn't pick it is that the only way you can watch it on any streaming service right now is this sub VHS rip on Amazon that is horrific to look at. Like, it looks so awful and makes the movie look so shitty and cheap. And then I would put on, like, the, you know, HD trailer, and it's breathtaking. And then I had to switch back to the Amazon, and it looked so bad. And I couldn't pick it for that reason.
Yeah.
But if we have an excuse to do a kid's thing down the line, I will absolutely recommend that movie again. But, like, the only way people could watch it at that time is in this. It's so frustrating. It looks so bad, dude. Anyway, my wife finally suggested and smartly suggested Dora.
The Explorer.
Well, that's the children's show, Jamie. This is for the tweens, okay? Or for the six-year-olds. and even though it is, like, directed by a white man, James Bobbin, whose works I have quite enjoyed, it still centers a largely non-white cast and has a smart and capable young woman at the center of it. And the premise is, like, what if Indiana Jones, but for younger kids, no guns, no Nazis, no misogyny, and it explicitly and repeatedly calls out the colonialist attitudes underpinning both that series and, like, the entire genre of exoticizing jungle adventure. That was, like, 20 minutes of me, you know, tripping over myself and my white guilt. And I apologize.
Well, you did good. I like the movie. I think that it achieves the goals that you have stated for it.
Yeah. But so after breaking your balls a while about you whiffing a lot of the pairings, I must confess here that I really only half-armed you to make a pairing here. So, I don't know, maybe I just, like, have to give you a, not a mulligan, what's it called in golf? You get a handicap on this one.
Hmm.
You get, I don't like this. I have to give it to you. I think you just get a free plus one to your score for the pairings for the miniseries because you paired this one blind. No, I'm not going to give you that. But I will say if we decide it does pair with Dora, you get 2 points. If we decide it doesn't, you get no points. But if we decide it does, you get 2 points.
Sounds great.
The scorekeepers are sitting on the edge of their seat right now. So, Jamie, with all of those things that I said that only described one of these two movies, although progressive, whimsical, and floral absolutely describes Dora and the Lost City of Gold.
Yes, I agree with that.
Not so much elegant or extremely British.
Yep.
Based on all those things, you paired this wine.
Cota 45, Bodegas Cota 45. This is from Jerez in Spain. This is their Miraflores bottling, vintage 2020, available this moment, at the moment of recording, at thespanyafinewines.com for $31. Scott's doing Popeye face again.
No, this is a different cartoon face. This is... Ugh. Jerez. Jerez is where sherry is that from, is, right?
That's where sherry is made.
You see, if I had looked ahead to the notes, I might have anticipated this moment.
Surprise.
You son of a bitch. Now, this is not a sherry.
This is not a sherry.
But there's notes of sherry. Is it the grape or is it the methodology? Shut up. You're going to get to all that later.
I'm going to get to all of it.
And as you recently noted, no one cares about that part anyway. Oh, it's got that sherry stank, that brown sugar, but wrong. Like, what if brown sugar was like an animal that died in the wall? Smell. Ooh. How high alcohol is this? This is very alcoholic, isn't it?
Nope. This is 12% alcohol by volume.
It feels higher than that. It's got that, like, that high-octane burn that I recall in the previous sherry that you cruelly paired with Mad Max Fury Road.
Which I still maintain worked.
Mm.
So, Scotty hates it.
No, it smells bad. The taste... We're starting at compelling. Let's see where we go by right. The end of this bottle.
I think it smells like dried apricots and, as you say, brown sugar and green almonds and, like, fresh sea breeze, peach rings.
Stop with the peach rings. You gotta stop bringing up the peach
rings. Don't tell me what flavor notes to use, despite the fact that they may be euphemisms for sex acts.
They 100% are. Salinity for sure. Salinity on the mouth. There's a salination station that I'm achieving here. Oh, wow. I really don't like the smell, though.
Mm.
It's got that sherry stank. I don't know. It is crisp. It is bright.
Mm-hmm.
Medium plus acidity.
Yeah. This one, I might even, like, go to high. This is pretty...
Son of a bitch. Son of a bitch. On every high acid wine recently, I have erred on the side of saying it's high acid. And you're like, I would actually say it's medium plus acidity. And then the one time I temper things, hang on. I still have my sense memory from a few hours ago. I'm going to do your goddamn drool test. And we're going to see what volume of oral secretions I produce.
Go on ahead. Enjoy.
That is one of the grosser things either of us has ever said on this show.
Yeah, one of, but certainly not the most. We say a lot of gross things on this show. Scott's grimacing as he swishes this wine around in his mouth. He's really, really hating on it. Just sipping on the haterade over here.
Nope. My mechanism says medium plus acidity.
Okay, good.
All right. So when I did the thing, what do you call it when you aerate within your own mouth, where you take a sip,
you swish it around?
No. All right. So that, I guess that's aerating, not the swishing, but when you, while there's wine in your mouth, when you draw air into your mouth.
I have no idea what that's called. I'm sure that the French have a word for it, but
I was getting a different note when I did that.
That, what's the different note?
Yeah, I'm not going to do that anymore because that brings out the sherry of it all the sherry things that I don't like. When I don't do that, when I don't aerate, it's the acid. The texture is nice. Is this medium plus body?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. But then all the sherry things are obscuring all the flavors. Dry?
Yep. Very dry.
Bone dry even?
Yep.
You said apricot, and I'm always suggestible. And also, I don't 100% know that I know what apricot tastes like until someone says the word apricot while I'm tasting a thing that tastes like apricot. And then, okay, maybe there's apricot in there. But like dried apricot,
that's what I think.
Dehydrated apricot, yep. Yeah.
Yeah, fresh apricot is its own particular flavor. Dried apricot is definitely more familiar to most of us, most of like our American palate. The season for apricots is really, really short. I got to give him credit. He's trying. He's trying to like it.
He always tries. I always try. A year ago, I'd have hated this. After my forced multiple sherry exposures, we're transcending. Compelling. It's more than compelling. Fuck. I might like it.
It's good. It's charming, right?
It's not charming. We don't agree about what charming means.
It's bringing you around, though. Like, it is convincing you that these are desirable flavors.
It is wearing me down. Something that is charming, nothing is a surprisingly charming. Something that is charming charms you immediately. You know, things that are charming do not withhold the charm for the most part. They're charming. They're forthright in their charmingness. This is wearing me down. This is like a friendship with you or with me. There's an acerbic unpleasantness and a lot of notes that are obnoxious and full of themselves and off-putting, and you are ultimately worn down through exposure and fucking Stockholm syndrome into thinking that it's actually appealing.
You hear that, all of our friends?
Sherry stank. They all know, by the way. They all know.
No, they genuinely like us because we are lovely people.
Thanks to the power of repeat syndrome. Exposure and Stockholm syndrome. That's right.
That's why it's right. Fucking good. It's so good.
What else are you getting in this? Because I'm blinded by the texture and by the offensive sherry notes that I guess I'm not that offended by. What else is going on?
Okay,
in there?
So as you say, brown sugar. There's definitely like an overriding caramelized character to it, like maybe a grilled peach even. It on the nose, it really has this strong sea breeze character to it. Like you're at any beach that is not the Jersey Shore, because that has its own particular smell.
Its own odor. Sorry, Jersey. Have we made fun of Jersey on the show before?
I don't think so.
I don't think we have. No,
but I mean, go to the beach in Atlantic City. It's got a smell.
No, did that once. That was enough.
We did that for your bachelor party.
Yeah.
It was a good time.
Boy, walking the casino floor in August in Atlantic City during deep into the decline of Atlantic City. It was a bunch of sad old fuckers playing the tables.
It was really sad.
That was really sad.
But we were very drunk. So it really didn't matter.
That is true.
So yeah, I get the sea breeze thing. I get this like Marcona almond situation that I think ties in the salinity with like a salted roasted Marcona almond thing. And then just like really fresh green Granny Smith apple. Dried apricot, for me, the fruit notes on the palate are really, really in the forefront. On the nose, it's that biological aging, the sherry underfloor note, which is like the almond and the brown sugar. But then you take it to the palate and it's like candied and dried fruits. And I find it to be just wonderful.
I don't think I like it. It is compelling. And there are things about it that I find familiar, but you know what I mean? That like that familiarity of a thing, like we've talked before about like for me, at least on my side of things, but like the way that your relationship to a movie can change over time and that you can forgive the flaws because of the things that you like about it or just by familiarity with it, that there's like a comfort food level to it.
Yep.
this is not comfort food, but I am recalling the Sherry's.
Right.
And that level of familiarity makes it less alien to me than it was before.
Yeah. You've been here before.
How many more bottles of things like this before do you think I'll ever like a thing like this?
I don't know. I really don't know.
Because I would like to, since I'm going to keep being subjected to them.
I'm just trying to find my way in. You know, the first one was just an unabashed, like, this is a Fino Sherry, and I know it's really tough to get with, and you hated it. And then the second one, I really thought we had a shot. It had a little bit of sugar. It had broad nuttiness, and I thought you were going to like the Oloroso style because it's a whole other thing, and you hated it.
Well, I did concede that it was compelling. I gave the Oloroso that it was compelling.
Yes, you did. This one, I think the floor character to it is a lot less of a dominant factor in the way that it was in the Inocente. And there's a lot more fruit. There's this really vibrant acidity. It hasn't lost all of its glycerol, so it still has some breadth to it. You know, on the palate, it's more of a conventional wine. The texture of the thing isn't that, like, really thin, like almost skeletal, precise thing that biologically aged wines that are aged for much longer can be.
Skeletal structure.
Yes.
I don't understand.
So what
the... Is this a metaphor? Are you saying it's like bone?
No.
Or that the structure is rigid?
No, it's a metaphor. The thing that floor removes from wine during biological aging is glycerol.
Which is a sugar.
Glycerol is a sugar which provides weight and breadth. Essentially, it's the thing that, like, you're perceiving as a fuller body.
Is the sugar.
This particular type of sugar.
Okay, great. Got it.
So the floor metabolizes glycerol and leaves behind what I think of as the bones of the wine. Rather than having that sort of like wash over your whole mouth and give you that sort of like full-bodied, mouth-filling perception, it's really, really like thin and precise. That's what like longer floor-aged wines do. This doesn't have that. This has more of a conventional wine structure to it on the palate.
I don't understand, but I don't know that I'm going to.
Yeah, I think I gave
I think the failing is the metaphor and not my drunk ass right now.
I disagree.
I think the metaphor is lacking.
Well, I explained it pretty thoroughly.
Well, I had to adjust your levels and I stopped paying attention, so I'm sorry.
There it is. On the palate, I just think this wine is a joy. It's really, really great. I opened a bottle of it at Southwark this past week. And, you know, as a revisit prior to this episode, and I thought it was showing spectacularly. This wine is showing similarly. I want to be drinking wines like this as often as I possibly can, but very, very few wines like this get made.
It's compelling, Jamie. It's compelling. It's complexing. I find it to be a roller coaster, right? Immediately, the nose, offensive.
Yep.
First taste, not crazy about it. Then it kind of settles on the palate for a few microseconds. Pretty cool. This is interesting. This tastes like wine. And then all the back of mouth sherry things happen and I get mad again. But there's a brief fleeting moment on every swallow of this that I find it interesting. More than interesting. Delightful. It's like delightful sandwiched in between a lot of things that I hate.
Well, you know,
whatever
what?
The opposite of delightful
is. I'm going to take the W on this one. I got you at least part of the way to enjoying something made under floor.
Well, before we move on, while Jamie is high on his fucking horse here, I did want to follow up on something we debated about in our previous episode.
Yes.
Where I was conceding that I know that smell and taste are like basically the same. And you're like, they are the same. They're the same. I'm didactic Jamie. I know things. They're exactly the same. They're processed in the same center of your brain.
Yep.
Well, I consulted.
With your wife.
With my wife, a double scientist with a BS in neuroscience.
Uh-huh.
And a, you know, other degree in pharmacy. Oh, wait, what is that one called? It's a doctorate.
Uh-huh.
And she says, no, that smell and taste do not go to the same center of the brain. She says, I don't know, this might be a typo, L-I-R-C. Is that internet abbreviation? Lurk?
I don't know it.
L-I-R-C, smell bypasses the hypothalamus. I have to ask her what lurk means. What is lurk? Maybe that's a typo for like smell bypasses the hypothalamus. if I recall correctly, not L-I-R-C, L-L-R-C, or I-I-R-C,
okay.
If I recall correctly. So anyway, she says you're wrong.
Yeah,
She says you're wrong.
I don't believe that to be true.
Is the important thing. So let us begin.
Let us talk about these movies.
So first up here, Dora and the Lost City of Gold. This is a 2019 film. It is directed by James Bobbin. You actually know a lot more of his work than maybe you think. James Bobbin was a series director on the Ali G Show.
Okay.
And I believe he directed some of the segments, if not all of the Ali G movie. He was also a series director on Flight of the Conchords, and he directed the two recent Disney Muppet movies. So
oh, cool.
The 2011 Lego sequel that with Jason Segel, and also the wildly underrated sequel to that, Muppets Most Wanted.
Which I still haven't seen.
It's
because
so good.
I remember the talk about it at the time to be like truly toxic.
The reviews were bad. They were, I avoided it forever. And also like, look, I love Tina Fey and I will hold 30 Rock on a pedestal forever. But like Tina Fey's movie roles have not always been fucking terrific. Like the things that she has been in have not been encouraging. And like, fuck Ricky Gervais. Ricky Gervais just sucks and is boring and hasn't been funny in 20 years. And so I just avoided it like the plague. I think it's a bad sequel to the Jason Segel Muppets movie, but it is a good sequel to the 70s and 80s Muppet movies.
Great.
It's not like what the internet thinks a Muppet movie needs to be, which is like a literary adaptation with one human and then all Muppets. Like it's a 70s or 80s, like Henson and Oz Muppet movie, where they're putting on a show and there's a caper and there's a bunch of adventure shit and there's a bunch of song and dance numbers and it's a globetrotting cameo filled adventure.
I'm sold.
It's so much fun.
So incredibly sold and so mad that I didn't watch
it
because
too.
The tell was so fucking toxic.
Yeah.
Somewhere along the line, I got it in my head that you had seen it and didn't like it.
No, I maybe I just repeated what I had heard that it was bad and disappointing, but like, no, those people are wrong. It's like legit good and people need to give it a shot.
Yeah. Cause I'm generally not one to like give a fuck what the critics or whatever say, but I do generally listen to you, which is like what that stuck in my head. And I was like, okay, I won't watch it. Scotty says that it's not good.
Yeah. Well, that's what I heard. And I was misled. Mm. Misled.
Well,
yeah. But anyway,
we remain on this earth and I can watch it whenever I want.
Yeah, that's right. Cause you subscribe to Disney Plus where you can watch it.
That's right.
And also you have to keep paying them the subscription plus a surcharge for using their IP on your tattoo.
F*** you.
Anyway, sidetrack. Dora, Lost City of Gold.
Yes.
Directed by James Bobbin.
James Bobbin.
And this is a live action, very loose adaptation of the like Nick Jr. cartoon from the late 90s and early aughts, Dora the Explorer. Jamie and I were much too old to have ever really seen any of that. And my child rearing has precluded me in the time that we do it and the way that I do it, that I just don't have to watch that television. Not to begrudge Dora, but to just like turn on the Nick Jr. and just let be on whatever's on. The show was this little girl, Dora, who was an explorer, and with her cousin Diego and her talking backpack and her other various talking animal friends, she taught children to speak English and Spanish at the same time. The movie's presumption is that all of that kind of happened and was largely the fantasy of young Dora.
Yep.
But now, many years later, she's a teenager, 16 years old, played by Isabella Merced in a truly fantastic and wonderful and singular performance as adolescent Dora. And her mom and her dad, played by Michael Pena and Eva Longoria, they refer to themselves as explorers, but like they're archaeologists, anthropologists, essentially.
Right. Yeah. I mean, she tells her classmates that they're professors.
That they're professors. Yeah. But they refer to themselves as explorers, and they all as a family live in the jungles of, I believe it's supposed to be Peru.
Yeah.
Another Peruvian connection here. But so mom and dad have to go off on an expedition. Dora is sent off to go live in the unnamed big city.
It's L.A.
Is it L.A.? I didn't think she crossed the border. They do the map thing.
They do the map, it is and LA. It's Hollywood. Like the
but
only
they never
other
say it is what I'm saying. It's unsaid.
I guess it's unsaid.
It is unsaid.
But it is on fucking screen. The plane stops in Hollywood.
But is it said?
God damn it.
I'm just saying. Also, Hollywood is not a city. It's like sort of a neighborhood in.
Sure, but it is shorthand frequently for L.A.
Fine. I'm just saying. Unsaid. Let it not be unsaid.
That
it was unsaid.
God, I hate you.
I know. It's great. But so Dora ends up as the fish out of water in high school in the big city with her cousin Diego, who she has not seen in many years. Skip ahead an act or two, and she's now back in the jungle on an adventure with Diego, two of their high school, not quite friends, more like frenemies.
Yep. They get kidnapped.
They do. They get kidnapped because some mercenaries want Dora to help them find her parents because they may or may not have actually found the lost city of Parapata.
Yep.
And along for the adventure with them is Alejandro, who may or may not be friend or foe, played by Eugenio Derbez, who most recently you may have seen him in Coda. He gives a really terrific, wonderful performance in the really horribly written part of the music teacher in that movie. Great performance, bad character. And it also features the voices of Benicio del Toro as Swiper, the talking fox who steals things, and opens the movie with a disclaimer that foxes don't swipe, which I feel like is like a reference for the kids who grew up with Dora that I fundamentally don't understand. Also with the voice talent's surprise of Danny Trejo.
Because of course.
Yeah. But so, yeah, it's a wacky, silly, I don't know. What did you think? Because my expectations coming into this were I didn't care and I wasn't interested. And then a couple of film people that I like on Letterboxd were like, oh, this is like legit good. And they gave it some reviews. So we threw it on with a child and he had a ball and I've watched it a couple times now and I've like really grown to like it quite a lot.
I was thoroughly charmed by it. The intro into the world is great, especially for someone who's, I think I've seen maybe 5 total minutes of Dora the Explorer in my life. I understand what the concept is. It's, you know, I've seen the advertisements for it and I understand that it's a learning show, that it's for kids and that it's bilingual. The bit in the beginning where she like breaks the fourth wall and talks to the camera and her parents are like, she'll get over that.
Yeah. She's at the dinner table talking to the camera and Michael Pena, who, God bless him, he's doing the same kind of work in this that he does in the Ant-Man movies where he just like shows up and throws a comedy fastball a couple of times and like gets a home run every time. Mixed baseball metaphors, but you know what I mean.
I do.
But yeah, he also tries to talk to the camera and is so funny every time he does it.
It's pretty good. Anyway, the point I was trying to make is that the introduction to the world is really complete. And so it didn't in the end matter that I had no familiarity with Dora the Explorer.
No, not at all. I think the only thing about the world that I find a little bit confounding is that like, so the movie sets up in the prologue where she's still a little girl and she and Diego are like doing their adventures with Boots, the CGI monkey who everyone just treats like he's a real monkey. And she's told like, don't put him in clothes. Monkeys aren't supposed to wear clothes. And then we see all their wacky adventures. And then that transitions to they're not actually driving a Jeep on an adventure. It's like a cardboard box, like facsimile of a Jeep. And oh, okay, great. So the adventures are actually things that they pretend. But then the CGI monkey is still real.
Yep.
And then the talking fox comes back and is 100% a talking fox with a mask, who is involved in the mercenary plot. Like the talking fox is essentially like a henchman to Belloc in Raiders of the Lost Ark. Like, and there's only one time that anyone is ever like, did that fox just talk? And we just move on right by it.
Yep.
And it doesn't ruin the movie for me, but it does make me question the reality that we're living in. But then the adventure rolls on and it's fine.
Yeah. It doesn't bother me at all. But for sure it is like, if you take a second to think about it, it doesn't make any sense at all. And then Boots later on ends up speaking, which is weird.
Yep.
It's all weird.
Yep. Also, they trip balls too.
Oh, yeah.
There's a terrific scene. Spoilers, I guess, mom and dads. But they're in like what feels like an increasing trend of psychedelic drug trip sequences that are like snuck into children's films. There's one in the not good Pixar movie, The Good Dinosaur, like where they eat magic mushrooms or something and fucking trip balls. And it's super surreal and freaky. A couple others I'm not thinking of, but yeah, they walk through
a field of like giant scary looking flowers.
Yeah. And then when the pollen is released, don't touch them. Right.
And then who touches them? Alejandro
bumps it. And then the pollen releases and they shoot spores out and then all the kids run away. And then all of them turn into hand animated or a CGI facsimile of 2D animated Dora cartoon show characters. And they acknowledge it, and it's trippy and weird and very fun and doesn't overstay its welcome. And then we go on to the next Indiana Jones-esque jungle set piece.
Yep. Yeah, it's charming. It's the story plays out really, really well. I really love the stuff in L.A. I was kind of sad that, like, so early on she got kidnapped and goes back to the jungle. Not that that stuff isn't good.
Yeah.
But, I mean, the high school stuff is a new lens to look at Dora through. And it's a very, it's a fish out of water thing. And they do a really good job of her relationship with Diego.
Yeah.
In the school.
He has a great line, and it's something like, my child is aware of the concept of bullying. I haven't underlined it too much with this movie, but there's a bit where they're going to go get on the school bus for the first time. And Diego is just suddenly realizing, like, oh my God, this girl is like this, basically like a cartoon character. Like, she's so earnest and so sincere, and she's fucking homeschooled and doesn't know how to relate to like real, like American high school kids. She's singing a song about her backpack, and he just takes her aside and takes her by the shoulders. And he's like, look, don't take it personally if I ignore you or pretend I don't know you today, okay? High school is a nightmare, or no, it's
a horrible nightmare that we're all just trying to survive.
Yeah, exactly. And then he just ditches her and pieces out.
Yep.
And like, I think he's genuinely quite good. I think the cast is like a little bit uneven, and I think she's amazing and he's quite good. And yes. I really like the two of them and their chemistry. And the high school scenes are terrific.
The dance sequence.
The dance is so good.
It's so good. And like,
and they, so cringy. She's trying so hard.
But then the scene where she's like, you know, getting mad at him, or he's getting mad at her for doing that.
Yeah.
There's this, the whole thing where she's like, I'm not stupid. I understand that they're mocking me.
Yeah, but I can only be me.
Only be me. Like,
yeah, and I'm not going to try to be somebody else.
I wish there was more of that meat to the thing.
Yeah.
Like, I can be no one but myself and shouldn't be asked to be anyone but myself.
I mean, I think that thread continues when they're in the jungle, but the problem with rushing back to it is that it puts her back in her comfortable element so quickly, right, that there's not more time for like that element of their relationship to struggle. I think what's crazy to me is like watching it, it's not something I would have expected, but it is so perfectly structured. Like in a very traditional, like Hollywood three act structure kind of way, like,
yeah,
it hits the, you know, first act, like introduction of conflict, like at exactly the right time, and then starts the second act, like escalation and complication of the conflict and introducing like additional characters all at the right time. And it all flows perfectly. And I think all the character beats and the catharsis lands exactly when and how it needs to.
Mm-hmm.
And yet, I completely agree that I wish there was more of the high school stuff, because it also, like, for a movie that very quickly gets very silly, and I don't know, there are parts of it that are clearly filmed in the jungles. I think they did some actual shooting in Peru, but a lot of the stuff in the jungles looks like it was shot on a soundstage to,
right,
me.
Which I'm not that bothered by, because it's a property that is like, it is a hand animated property. Like, she kind of looks like a cartoon herself.
Perfect. Hair, makeup, and costuming on her.
Exactly.
Yeah. I'm surprised that for a movie that has such a level of unreality, once they were, like all the jungle sequences, mm-hmm, that the high school stuff they nail so well. I mean,
right,
recent events that need not be spoken about on this stupid show, but like the part where Dora and Diego have to go through the metal detectors at the high school is a great comedy sequence. Like, genuinely hilarious comedy sequence of her having to justify why she has an emergency flare and a fucking like double hammock for cave, mm-hmm, sleeping and
the meals and then like disputing the fact that she's allowed to bring the yo-yo in, yeah, which is
her deadliest weapon.
When I say I wish there was more of the high school stuff, what I really mean is I wish this was a story about her at high school
and never became a jungle adventure movie.
Correct. Like, it could be, I'd be happy, and in fact, I think it wouldn't really resonate with maybe fans of the show if it wasn't an adventure movie at all.
Mm.
But like, you can do an adventure set in LA,
yeah,
and still have them returning to class and navigating the structures of being a high schooler.
Or it should be the third act should be the return to the jungle. Like the second act, all of the complicating is her and the same cast of kids on this misadventure trying to escape captivity or something.
Right.
In the high school or in the museum or somewhere in the city. And then the second act is like, oh no, Diego gets captured. And then she has to like get on a plane with her friend.
And then suddenly she's back in,
right,
her.
And now that she's learned like new interpersonal skills, is now able to like recruit the other kids to go. Like the same emotional and dramatic arc of the movie, but just more of it with her as the fish out of water. I totally agree. I would like that version more. And yet I still quite like this
I'm
one.
I'm still extremely charmed by it. It's certainly larger than a nitpick. I'm suggesting a massive change to the plot.
It's a sizable rewrite. Yeah.
That being said, I do like the version that is there.
Yeah.
I really found myself compelled by the high school stuff, and it left me wanting more of that because that's what resonates.
Yeah, I concur. I do concur with that. And yet all the adventure stuff I do really dig. I also just love that character. Again, with like no prior knowledge of Dora in like any other medium, the characterization, that performance by Isabella Merced, like it's such a fine line to walk where like she has to be believable as some kind of evolution of like a children's cartoon character, an adventurer. She has to bring the homeschool component to it, the fish out of water level, the incredibly self-possessed and intelligent and bright and sunny and confident and willing to sing her way through any problem, including other people's problems, like suggesting that the other girl, Sammy, sing a song about having to drop a deuce in the jungle.
It's so fucking perfect.
Jamie, are you going to be singing the poo song whenever you need to use the restroom?
I did last night.
Yeah.
Sang myself a little ditty while I was pooping.
Sang the poo song.
It's a hard character to nail, both from a performance perspective and from a writing perspective.
For sure, the writing is a big part of it. It's a very special performance, I think. She's so incredibly compelling and watchable.
But also, how do you square up to that performance?
Right.
Like, and try and deliver a naturalistic performance.
Right. Yeah. It's, I don't know. I don't know how one would do it.
Yeah.
I do really like Eugenio Derbez, who plays Alejandro.
Yep.
Spoilers, if you've never seen a movie before, you'll be shocked to find out that he, though presenting himself as an ally in the beginning, is in fact the big bad, revealed about halfway through the movie. Genuinely funny and appealing character and kind of fearless too. Like he gets one of the most striking moments in the whole movie, which is there. I thought you would have loved this. There's the quicksand sequence where they end up in quicksand and it's all fart jokes about the quicksand. And he makes a bunch of pretty lame jokes about like, oh, I just ate some chimichangas and fart noise. But then he is the only one who doesn't follow Dora's like quick thinking directions about how to survive and escape the quicksand. And he thinks he's going to drown. And then they ultimately rescue him. And he has like a complete and totally reasonable and emotionally grounded panic attack about the quicksand.
Yep.
And about not only was he nearly drowning in it, but then scorpions were like mating on top of his head and just a total freak out. And he brings so much, I don't want to say depth or gravitas, but like there's an emotional reality to that I really didn't expect like 2 minutes after he was making fart jokes about the Mexican food he ate.
For sure. I fully agree with that.
Really like him and Isabella as Dora are like both super dialed in and know exactly what to do. And also I always love Michael Pena. Michael Pena should be in more things. He should always be there as a little bit of seasoning. Because he's always so fucking funny. This makes me laugh and my son never quite understands why I think it's so funny. But when before Dora is about to go off to the city to high school and the parents take her aside and he goes off on this riff about, look, you're going to make some friends and they're going to take you to parties. And those parties are called raves. And
the people at them are called ravers. Called
ravers. And then he proceeds to like scat his way through some version of like dubstep or house music. And the funniest part is not just him like doing a pretty spot on like building, escalating version of what like that type of dance music would sound like. But Eva Longoria, you think the mom is going to be like rolling her eyes and telling him he's stupid or just waiting for him to be done.
She's with him.
And she's like, yep, great. And they never get to the part where they're like, don't do drugs or have safe sex or whatever. It's just be aware of dubstep. And the two of them are so incredibly funny in that brief little moment. I think it's great. I'm a big fan.
I'm really, really charmed by it. I was kind of surprised that it was the one that you went with, put it on last night, had a blast.
Yeah, it's a good time. And I also like, again, this is like part of what I liked about it, like just to share with my son and, you know, he'll understand some of the vocab words more as he gets older, but also as a selection for the miniseries is like it centers like a young Latina character and she has her head on her shoulders and she calls out bullshit wherever she sees it. And there's the moment in the English class where the teacher's like, who is Moby Dick? And why is the novel so important? And Dora raises her hand and she's like, he's the whale, and this is a book about the exoticization and exploitation of indigenous culture, and that's why it's part of the great Western canon of literature. Like, fuck yeah, Dora!
She's so self-possessed and brilliant and just uncompromising. She knows things, like, for certain, and has no amount of embarrassment sharing what she knows with people. And she expresses it. Like, she knows that she'll receive ridicule for it, but she can be no one but herself.
Yeah. It's a nice lesson for children.
I agree.
It really is. As someone who, throughout my entire adolescence and childhood and, you know, many of the years to come, I struggled with, like, you know, you
self-confidence.
You don't come up as a Star Trek obsessed dork in the 90s without learning to hide the things that you love the most.
Yep.
Oh, and then I put that behind me, and then comic books, and I was only like 15 years too early for everybody to give a shit about Spider-Man.
Right.
So anyway, I empathized and admired that an awful lot about the character.
It's a little bit of homeschooled energy. Shout out Johnny Words.
Shout out Johnny Words. Homeschooled energy for sure. That like it's a merger of. How do we just, Jamie, give me the flavor notes on homeschool energy. Like it's a little okay, bit so theater can, kid,
it
right?
It can verge into like a full unawareness of the social situations that go on to the point where you become like, or that person becomes off-putting and you don't want to be around them. But I think on the positive side, on the Johnny Words side of homeschooling.
The Johnny Words of it all.
If I were to compliment him ever, which I'm not, I don't frequently do.
May he rest in peace.
May he rest in peace. It's that unselfconscious knowledge of your own abilities. Say what you will about Johnny Words.
J Words.
The man knows what he's an expert in and also knows what he's not an expert in.
He does not know what he's not an expert in. Yo, boy was shit-talking Star Trek fans the other day and was acting like he knew what he was talking about.
Sometimes, all right.
Sometimes he just reads internet and thinks, oh, I know things about this.
That's fair.
Step off of Star Trek, Johnny Words, and you'll find yourself called out on this show again in the future.
Shit.
That's his favorite part. He likes when we talk about him.
He does.
Jonathan Wirtz.
Listen, I was watching Dora in this movie thinking, this is a little bit J Words out here.
this is
a
little Jonathan Wirtz.
Jonathan Hamilton Wirtz.
Jonathan Hamilton Wirtz. There's another one. There's another thing I wanted to. Oh, and then something else when I was watching it last night with the child, and I just thought this was like catnip for you with your disdain for the old world is when all the kids they're talking about how the, you know, the Incans were pillaged by the Spanish. And then Diego's like, oh, don't forget the French and the English. Don't forget the Americans and the Dole Fruit Company. Like,
the
man.
When they dropped Dole Fruit, I was like, hands up in the air.
Yep.
Yes.
And it's just straight up true. And it's not just that they like call out the countries, but to specifically call out like a major American corporation.
Yep.
That felt braver than I expected from something from the Viacom company, you know?
Yeah.
I don't know. I feel like it's pretty well documented, all the terrible things that the American agriculture industry has done
to South America specifically. Yes.
Yeah.
And Dole is the prime leader of like atrocities committed.
Yeah. Anyway, good movie. Watch it with your children.
And maybe avoid talking about the atrocities committed by the fruit conglomerates.
Yeah, wait till they're older.
Yeah, just a little bit. Wait until they're Dora's age.
Yeah, or talk about it and just peel the stickers off your bananas. Anyway, I don't think I said this before. Dora and the Lost City of Gold, check it out on the Paramount Plus.
Yes, indeed.
Paramount Plus, a streaming service, because everybody that has a media brand has to have a streaming service until they get acquired by another media brand to merge with their streaming service. I'm so looking forward to probably the ruination of my beloved HBO Max, thanks to the merger of Time Warner Entertainment and Discovery. It'll be Discovery, Max, HBO, Warner Plus, or whatever I don't know. All the branding is terrible. Anyway, Paramount, check it out. 7-day free trial, or just keep subscribing. There's all kinds of great shit on there, including one of my favorite movies of 2022 so far, Jackass Forever.
I need to see that.
You really do?
Yeah.
You really do?
I'm going to watch it.
All right.
It's going to happen.
All right. So, moving on from the jungles of Peru, straight into the jungles of Peru.
The jungles of Darkest Peru.
Darkest Peru, which just sounds ugly even when I was typing it in the outline yep. last night. I didn't care for
they
that.
They could have cut that part. They could have just said Peru.
Yeah.
I mean, they
don't mean skin tone darkest Peru. I know, they mean it just the deepest parts
sound
of,
good.
You know, where the canopy is so dense of the jungle.
I understand.
I know. Anyway, we're talking about my boy, Paddington 2.
Paddington Brown.
Paddington Bear. Or Paddington Brown Knee Bear. Is that how you do it? Is that
yeah,
how,
when I think you... I think you got it.
So Paddington 2, 2017 feature film. As mentioned previously, this is one of Film Twitter's very, very favorite movies. 2017 sequel to 2014's very underseen and underrated Paddington. Both of those movies are written and directed by Paul King. King, who will not be coming back for Paddington 3, which breaks my heart, because he is off writing and directing, and I think now they're probably done shooting the Wonka prequel.
Really?
Starring Timothy Chalamet.
Timmy Cham Cham.
So everything about this leaves me conflicted and confused. But so yeah, the movie follows the misadventures of Paddington Bear, or Paddington Brown, a genteel bear from darkest Peru living in London. The first movie is the story of Paddington's refugee saga emigrating to England, finding a home with the Brown family and avoiding getting taxidermied by a terrifying Nicole Kidman.
She's so great.
She's so good, right?
She's so fucking good.
Everybody rightfully raves about the villain performance in the sequel, who we will talk about, but it kind of overshadows just how fucking note perfect Nicole Kidman is in the first one.
Pitch perfect. It was beautiful.
Great performance.
The first Paddington was the first movie that I watched for this miniseries. Prior to you putting them in any order, I was just like, I'm going to start watching movies.
And then I dropped Paddington from the miniseries.
Which is fine, because I would have probably watched the first one anyway.
And it's lovely.
And really the gift of that movie is Nicole Kidman as a villain.
Yeah, I mean, she is quite special.
Yep.
It's a really nice performance. But so the sequel, Paddington 2, that we're here to talk about today, sees Paddington firmly settled in his posh London neighborhood, his good nature and generosity demonstrably having improved the lives of everyone around him, while he works as a window washer to earn money to buy a gift for his Aunt Lucy, who is also a CGI bear, for Aunt Lucy's upcoming 100th birthday. The gift that he wants to get her is a one-of-a-kind pop-up book, or popping book. But when said pop-up book is stolen and Paddington is framed for the theft, he has to adjust to life as a convict, while his adoptive family, the Browns, try to find the real thief and clear his name. Ben Whishaw provides the voice of Paddington. Delightful Ben Whishaw performance.
You are shouting him out on your t-shirt right now.
That's right. I've got yet another Super Yaki t-shirt here, with credit block for and the voice of Ben Whishaw as Paddington. Hugh Bonneville also plays patriarch of the family, Henry Brown. Sally Hawkins is Mary Brown. Brendan Gleeson is Paddington's prison frenemy turned bro for life, Knuckles McGinty.
Best fucking name.
This is such an amazing Brendan Gleeson performance. Jim Broadbent returns as Mr. Gruber, the owner of the shop where Paddington wants to get the very important pop-up book. And Hugh Grant plays the villainous Phoenix Buchanan, a washed-up stage actor who stole the pop-up book for his own nefarious ends. Hugh Grant has described this as the best movie he has ever appeared in, and no one can disagree with him about that.
Love that.
And it's his best performance in his entire career. And I'm not like a Hugh Grant person, but like the guy's he's a good actor. He has brought it in many a film. God, he's so fucking perfect in this movie.
He's so good. He's funny and he's menacing and
God, he's so good. And most of his scenes he plays by himself.
Yep.
With no one to play off of except the various
mannequins.
Personas that he plays. Oh my God, he's so good. Paddington 2, a perfect movie, a beautiful little object that you should watch right now with or without children. It's on the HBO Max or wherever you get your VOD rentals.
Yeah, it's joyful. And if you don't like it, don't talk to me.
Well, you heard it here first, everybody. Well, you know what? I'm going to co-sign. Normally, I'm not on board with you being belligerent to people. And you're all like, oh, well, you know, wine is a subjective thing and everything's buddy's taste and you can like whatever you want. But if you don't like this movie I just saw for the first time, don't talk to me. Go fuck yourselves. These are two different voices, neither one of which
but
really
sounds
like you at all.
But you're going to co-sign the one that you're making sound bad.
Normally, I don't, but in this case, because Paddington is beautiful and wonderful, and if you don't like it, I don't know who you are. I don't know who you are.
This is what I'm saying.
It's special. It's like a one-of-a-kind special thing.
If you don't like A Town Called Panic, That's fine.
It's pretty weird.
It's super weird. We probably aren't going to be the closest friends if you don't like A Town Called Panic. That's like, that movie also speaks my language in a very deep and profound way. Oh, Scott's doing Popeye face again.
This wine does not speak my language.
I am so fucking loving this wine. I'm loving drinking it while talking about these movies. I'm having a great time. I hope you are too.
Ooh.
But yeah, if you don't like Paddington 2, don't talk to us.
Jamie, tell me all your thoughts about Paddington 2.
Well, first of all, Sally Hawkins.
Isn't she lovely?
She's so good.
She plays such a wonderful... Ditz is the wrong word.
It's not.
Because ditz implies that she's dumb, but she's like, she's scatterbrained.
She's
a children's book artist and like mother of 2/3 with the bear included.
Yep.
And she's scatterbrained and silly and so affable and goofy. God, I love that performance.
It's,
Hugh Bonneville as Henry. Holy shit.
Yes. Hugh Bonneville kills it. And that one scene early in the movie where he gets passed over for a promotion. Oh, that was a gut punch.
Mm-hmm.
And he sells it so, so well.
And also,
the douchebag who got promoted behind him. That guy, I don't know who that guy is, but excellent douchebag performing. Yeah.
This promotion passover that leads to him having a
midlife crisis.
Hilarious midlife crisis that plays out over the course of the movie.
But yeah, Sally Hawkins, like towards the end, diving in to save the day. Oh my God, so good. And... there's so much to love about this movie. Obviously, fucking Hugh Grant is like 20 of the reasons I love this movie.
It's a bananas performance. Like, and it's so selfless.
Yep.
You know, like he gives so much to the movie and he goes big and broad and makes a complete mockery of himself and allows himself to look foolish in like a half dozen different ways.
Sure does.
Oh God, Hugh Grant's so funny.
He's a good one. We love him. But he fucking nails it in this movie. The performance from the bear, from Paddington.
So are we talking about...
the digital performance.
The CGI bear performance.
Yep.
Which is wonderful.
It's heart-wrenching.
Yeah.
It really is. Like, the hard stare is hilarious.
The hard stare is funny every single time.
Every single time. And that it like, gets to Brendan Gleeson so profoundly. Oh, and his performance, like, against that. And he's like, I know about hard stares.
Look at me. I invented the hard stare.
So fucking good. But the thing, fucking, I broke down and had an ugly cry at the end of this movie. Like a big old weepy when...
every time.
When Aunt Lucy shows back up.
Spoilers, but yes, when... yeah, the conclusion of the movie and Aunt Lucy makes a surprise. And it's not just that she shows up, but it's that the whole neighborhood effectively like pooled their resources to bring her to him. I cry so hard every time I watch it. And we watch this movie a bunch.
Yeah, I haven't had a big cathartic cry in a while. Like I've tried and I've definitely needed it because there are emotions surrounding me.
Well, there are all the things, Jamie. There's all the terrible things.
But it's felt like there's been like a little bit of a stop up, you know, like
a little backed up.
I'll get sad and then there will be the desire or the inkling or the whatever to cry. And then I'll just get like a couple of tears out and be done and be like, well, that was not what needed to happen. And then Aunt Lucy shows up and half an hour of just sobbing.
Oh, wow.
And a whole fucking box of tissues. Like, done.
It's real powerful.
Hit me.
Yeah.
Gut punch.
It's just so lovely and so sweet. And like the first one is a genuinely very good movie.
Yep.
And then the second one is like superlative.
Yep.
And there's just so many things about it that work. The artistry of it.
I was just thinking.
Exquisite artistry, like the pop-up book sequence.
So beautiful.
When he sees this pop-up book that's just like all the places of London, right? All the locations.
Yep.
And he imagines himself giving Aunt Lucy a tour of London.
That almost made me cry.
That
nearly got me there.
Miracle. But yeah, they're if you haven't watched the movie, go watch it right now. Oh my God, go watch Paddington 2. You're welcome. You can tell me thank you via DM and please leave a rating for the show and tell us which of your Marvel movies is the favorite. So Jamie has to watch it and complain the whole time.
God damn it.
But now that you've watched the movie and you're back, you know that the pop-up book sequence is it's like fully photo real, as much as that gets, CGI Paddington and Aunt Lucy walking through a 3D to scale version of these pop-up book locations around London. And it's arresting to look at, but also just this lovely idea of like, it just gives you this window into like his heart and his thinking. Like,
and the movement of it too is
so graceful.
It is breathtaking. And it just keeps you apace, and every page turn gives you a new emotion or a new aesthetic or a new thought. Fucking beautiful.
Yeah.
Unreal. Also, the hot air balloon sequence.
You mean the escape from prison into the hot air balloon? The escape from prison sequence, which is just straight up a Wes Anderson sequence.
Yes.
It's like, they're like, what if we took the escape from prison sequence in Grand Budapest Hotel and added a CGI bear and possibly even more whimsy?
How you can add more whimsy is beyond me, but there it is on screen.
Did you? There's very much a Wes Anderson vibe to this
big
movie.
Time. I mean,
not all the time, but especially all the prison sequences.
I was just going to say, looking out at the prisoners in the dining hall, all in pink.
Mm-hmm. And the perfect symmetrical compositions and the little diorama montages of the prison. When the warden's model of the prison turns into the actual prison, and we can see Paddington and Knuckles like making their escape through the like cross section of like the floorboards and the tunnels and stuff.
I need to watch this movie again. I've only seen it once, and it's not enough times.
It's enormously rewarding to watch many times. We're talking about all the artistry and, you know, fucking name checking people like Wes Anderson, but then it's also a very broad comedy.
Yes.
The first one, like, and all the trailers for the first movie were like, he's a CGI bear and it's a family in London and they're going to get up to it some adventures, but maybe they'll love each other, coming to theaters soon. And it's just like, it looked like a nothing of a movie.
Right.
And like, it has all the slapstick and the goofy shit and him like using electric toothbrushes in his nostrils and his ears, and it's super gross. And there's a bit in the first one where he floods the entire bathroom and then rides the bathtub down the spiral staircase. Terrific little sequence. But like, this one has just as much of the silliness. The whole, it's a little bit Buster Keaton-y, the escalation in the barbershop sequence.
I was literally about to mention this sequence.
The barbershop
sequence
is so funny. And when he uses the marmalade to paste the judge's hair back on his shaved head.
Oh, so perfect.
And then, oh God, it's so good.
Chef's
it's so
kiss.
Good. And so silly. And yeah, it plays like gangbusters every time. My son and I, he just laughs so much throughout this movie.
Makes me want a marmalade sandwich. Not going to lie.
Oh, we've got some downstairs after he went like deep on the Paddington movies and we watched them a bunch. I think that was an early pandemic project for us. We made marmalade one time.
Hell yeah.
But he didn't understand why, like, my hands, which are much larger than my son's, but they're not, you know, orange squeezers the way that Brendan Gleeson's fucking mitts are, where he can just squeeze an orange and it explodes and all the juice. The whole marmalade making sequence is wonderful.
Yep.
Or the way that Knuckles melts in a very like Anton Ego Ratatouille kind of way, when like Knuckles is the guy in charge of the prison kitchen, but just makes slop and doesn't really care about food. And then Paddington accidentally shoves one of his haphazard marmalade sandwiches into his mouth, and just the way he just freezes. And like, there's some kind of like one of those magic, like sense memory food things that like a transportative thing.
Yep.
And then it changes his whole worldview. And now he's going to protect the bear. It's very much like him and Paddington in that moment is like the pit bull and Babe.
I was just
going to
say,
too.
Yes.
He's just like, now I will protect the bear.
Although Brendan Gleeson remains a little bit, it remains a little bit hostile to Paddington.
Yeah.
Like, you're now going to produce this marmalade with me, and I'm going to continue to be a dick until I, you know, end up falling in love with you because you're an amazing creature.
Yeah. Well, he makes the world better just by his presence, even though it's difficult for him.
Well, and even though he sometimes has Looney Tune antics where he kind of ruins everything.
He does ruin things. Sometimes
he's
but only in funny ways.
He's clumsy.
Yeah,
he's very clumsy.
He's because he's a cartoon bear, Jamie. Leave him alone. All right,
listen.
Clumsy.
Hey, he's clumsy. I'm not saying he's bad. I'm not saying he's at fault. I'm just saying sometimes he ruins things. Like in the real world, in that sequence, in the bathroom sequence from the first one. Oh my God, the water damage in that house.
pretty catastrophic.
You would have to move.
I mean, Mr. Brown was trying to get bear insurance added to the house at the time.
So you were talking about the marmalade making sequence in this movie.
Yeah.
The marmalade making sequence in the first Paddington also, when he's doing it with Aunt Lucy.
With Aunt Lucy and Uncle Pastuzzo.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh my God. That one also tugs on the heartstrings. It's the, that like.
That little bit of family.
Making food with your family.
Yeah. Oh man. And when Uncle Pastuzzo dies in the first one, very elegantly depicted, like it's the classic, we talked about it last episode, like the Disney thing of like, you know, the parent always has to die in the beginning. And like Uncle Pastuzzo dies and it's both horrifying and yet not violent at all. And it's not depicted, but it's alluded to and you know exactly what happened. And then he picks the hat up and like, oh man, it gets me so good.
It really does.
Yeah, it's a real special movie.
Took the words right out of my mouth.
The thing that I am always so surprised by, so like the first one is very much, they're very political movies without being overtly, explicitly political. But like the first one is a refugee story, right? Like Paddington is sent to the old world. He's sent to London to escape like a natural disaster in his home. And is basically like homeless at the train platform at Paddington Station, and is fortunate that he's like actually taken in, and then they have to like deal with,
because Sally Hawkins is wonderful,
because she's just a sweetheart. She's so nice and has such a big, warm, welcoming heart.
Once again, I love her in this movie.
She's really good.
In both movies. I think she's fucking fantastic.
Yeah, I mean, the first one is like is reckoning with the evils and the legacy of colonialism, right? Like your villain character is the daughter of like a white explorer, you know, South American plunderer, essentially. And then Paddington has to deal with not only her being after him, but then also like the racist, xenophobic fucking Peter Capaldi neighbor who comes back in this one. And then
who
the second
in this
movie.
One is totally neutered, just like not even a nuisance to anyone.
Well, he's a nuisance at the end when he tries to stop them from going to rescue Paddington.
True. Yeah. But for most of it, he's just like whinging.
He's just annoying and everyone hates him.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then this one, like the humanity and the compassion that it gives to all of the convicts feels like the big, like, not mission statement. It's like, not like the movie is like lecturing you. It feels like the one big political humanistic element that they're trying to get forth, that like people in prison, they're not just prisoners. We can't just look at them and see the uniform and assume that they're bad people and that they're all scary.
Right.
Like it's a children's movie. So we're not going to talk about like, we don't really get into what any of their crimes are. Like a couple of them are mentioned. You get a sense that like the one guy's a white collar criminal, but like it's not about that. It's about their humanity and the way that they relate to each other and the way that they can come together. And then through Paddington's influence through food and through getting them all to share foods that are important with them, the whole culture of the prison is elevated.
Yep.
The warden ends up reading stories to them all over the PA system by the end. They all have like a beautifully decked out like pastry dessert dining room that they all eat in. Like it just elevates the culture. And then the closing credits musical number, because now his fortunes are reversed and villainous Phoenix Buchanan is in jail and he gets to put on his big West End Broadway musical number.
Very much producer's vibes on that one.
But now he's in a prison that Paddington has essentially reformed from the inside. And Paddington has made the culture better so that they will all embrace Phoenix. And now Phoenix is giving them another gift, which is musical theater and the idea of performance and engaging in like something collaborative and artistic in that way. And I don't know. My son and I, like we watch cartoons, right? So let's say we're watching like a Batman cartoon, or we were just watching a Superman cartoon the other day, and there was a prison break, and Superman has to round up all the prisoners, and they're all bad guys, and they always end up fighting.
Right.
And like prisoners are always depicted in like those types of action adventure things as like they're all just violent criminal prisoners, and they have to be rounded up, and they all want to escape, and they're terrible. And this movie is such a counterpoint to that. And like, yeah, they're in jail, but they're people.
And it doesn't mean that they're bad people necessarily.
Yeah, you can do a bad thing and still like make a delicious strawberry shortcake, you know?
Paddington.
Yeah.
Paddington went to prison.
Well, I mean, he was framed, Jason.
He was framed.
He didn't do it.
Just saying.
Also, the chase sequence. The big chase where he's riding the fucking wolfhound.
Yep.
So funny.
So fucking good.
Yeah. Oh, it's special. I'm glad it made you cry so much. I'm glad you're glad that it made you cry so much.
I was like so elated and so happy, and we've like finished the movie, and then I realize what's about to happen, and I'm like, uh-oh.
Well, because you're already on an emotional precipice by that point, because it seems as though the climax is going to be that Paddington is going to drown, locked in his train car,
yep.
And Mrs. Brown swims down, and she can't get the bars off, and yep. then fucking Knuckles and all the other guys fly over, and they come back and rescue him, and it's just like, that just gets me so much, and it gets you right to the edge of the waterworks. And then the music cues start up, and every time, I'm getting chills just thinking about it, but every time those music cues start up and you realize, well, we couldn't get the pop-up book back because it's evidence. Oh, well, Aunt Lucy won't have a gift.
Or will she?
Oh my God, I lose it. So beautiful. Movies.
Yep.
Movies. What if films for children could be like beautiful art as well, that still allow children to have silly talking animals and slapstick and chaos?
I cannot co-sign that harder.
Yeah. This one will always be special to us. This was my son's first movie in a theater. He'd already seen it a couple of times. He was 2 and a half, I think. And our local art house, Ye Olde County Theater in Doylestown, was doing it as one of their like weekend morning matinees for kids. And I took him and was like, well, you know, worst case, he's 2 and a half. Maybe he gets rammy. Maybe he gets scared because it's like big and loud. Like, he's seen the movie before, and we're members and tickets cost us a couple bucks and we'll just leave.
Yeah.
I still have a picture of it, of him sitting in my lap, looking up at the big screen and just like enthralled at the idea of like a movie being that large and not just on our television. And he loved it and sat in my lap the whole way through. And then he was 2 and a half. So like after an hour and a half of the movie, he fell asleep. And I kind of like jostled him, and I'm like, hey, buddy, do you want to get out of here? And he's like, yeah, let's go home. So I pick him up and I put him on my shoulder, and I've got the fucking diaper bag. God, I don't miss diaper bag at all. And I've got like the leftovers of like his popcorn, and like, I've got everything squared away, and we're out to the vestibule, and the door closes. And then I realized that he'd been awake looking over my shoulder on the way out of the theater, and he whimpered a little bit. Can we go back and watch the rest of the movie?
Yep.
Bet your ass, buddy. Absolutely. Let's get back in it. And we watched like the climax of the movie.
That's so
and
fucking
he loved
great.
It the whole time.
Oh my God.
But so yeah, these movies will always be special for me. And again, like as somebody who like, I look at the world through movies, and through my parenting, he is doing that a lot as well. Like, mm-hmm. it's important for me to give him some kind of example that shows that the carceral state is maybe like an evil that's been inflicted upon the Western world. And that maybe we should look at people who are in prison as just people who still have like warmth and value and pain and good things to offer to us all. Movies.
The fucking movies. This is top tier when it comes to children's entertainment, right? Like this is the model that you want your child to look at the world through.
Yeah. You want them to look at the world like Paddington does, and like, oh, how can I help?
Yeah.
How can I do nice things for everyone?
How can I just make everything better by my simple presence?
Yeah. All right, moms and dads. That's it. That's the end of the miniseries. I hope you all enjoyed it. That should be the lesson that we take out into the world. Help our kids see things in ways that are better. Jamie has nothing else to add. Good night, everyone. We'll see you later.
We got to talk about wine, Scotty.
Fuck. You son of a bitch.
What?
I'm just mad at you. You did it with Tenet. Fine, because we were both spiting each other. You did it with Mad Max.
Mm-hmm.
That was fucking low. You did it with Paddington 2. Something pure and beautiful, like a gorgeous confection.
This wine is delicious, Scott. It's wonderful. And I'm sorry that you don't have any taste. No, I'm legitimately sorry. I wish that I was hoping that the very moderate floor influence on this wine, and the, in my mind, the sort of expansive fruit character on the palate would charm you into liking not, I wasn't trying to bridge the gap to, for you to like all sherry, but I was hoping that you would like this one.
I like it more than the others.
Well, that's, once again, we're going to take a W.
I mean, fine. This is the only W you're going to get, because this doesn't fucking pair with either one of these movies. But please continue. I apologize.
So the thing that... stop doing Popeye face. It's not that bad, you big wimp.
Oh, there's an ant on my leg.
Oh, poor guy. Ugh. He's got ants on his leg.
I'm not complaining. I was describing with no inflection.
You had a look of complaint on your face, but I guess that was about the wine.
That's right.
Fuck. All right. So this wine is from Jerez, which is where sherry comes from. The big thing that separates this from sherry proper is that it is not from a Solera. This is a single vintage wine.
So it's just one butt.
Sure.
Are there any butts?
Yes.
So it is a butt. I'm not just being facetious. I accidentally was right about something.
Yeah, but I mean, this is large enough production that there are several butts. But it's one vintage gets released. They fill them up. It gets aged under floor for 8 months, and then it gets released. Well, bottled and then released.
So that's what constitutes the butt, is the being in a barrel aged under floor.
The barrel is the butt.
Are all barrels called butts?
No, the ones from sherry are called butts. They have a specific capacity.
Wait a minute. Part two of an ongoing wine classification argument from last week.
Uh-huh.
Is sherry also a place?
Yeah.
I thought it was Jerez. I thought Jerez was the place.
It's an anglicization of Jerez. Sherry.
Sherry.
Because the British are terrible. Scotty's mad. I can see him.
So sherry is the place.
Well, Jerez is the place.
And sherry is the product, but also the place.
Correct.
And what is the grape?
Palomino.
And why does it taste like this? Because of the floor. Because of the underfloor aging.
The biological aging. So for anyone who needs a little bit of a refresher, I'm not saying this is aged under a floor, F-L-O-O-R. It is aged under floor, F-L-O-R, which is a particular strain of yeast that grows on the top layer of the wine. Essentially, it covers and protects the wine from oxygen while it is in a barrel.
Can this constitute this week's segment of I ask things that you've explained before so that Johnny Words will feel good because he loves when I do that?
Johnny Words in memoriam, yes.
Okay, great. We've already talked about him enough this episode.
We definitely
Moving
have.
On. His segment has been checked off.
So this wine gets aged under floor for 8 months. It is unfortified, which is different than other sherry.
Typically, no alcohol is added.
Correct.
That's what fortified means.
Yes.
Alcohol is added.
That's right.
And this is not that.
That's right. So yeah, rather than killing the floor by adding alcohol, they just filter it out or rack it off. I'm actually not 100% certain on that specific detail. But this winery, it's called Cota 45. It's a reference to 45 meters above sea level, which is where this particular winemaker, Ramiro Ibanez, thinks the best Palomino is grown. This guy was born in the region. He left to get an enology degree and then travel the world making wine in other places for a couple of years. Then he came back to the town of Sanlúcar de Barrameda, which is where specifically Manzanilla sherry is made. Manzanilla is a style of sherry, but also tied to the specific place of Sanlúcar. So Ramirez spent years traveling. He returned home in 2009 and was consulting at various bodegas around Sanlúcar, making sherry proper. Then in 2012, he started Cota 45. He rented out an old boat shop as a place to make his wine. He's doing this thing which has been a through line through this mini series, which is focusing on native varieties and old vines in an area that largely got dominated by larger production commercial wines. The larger production commercial part is a little bit older here because we're talking about British colonialism in Jerez. Sherry wouldn't be sherry without the British. One of the reasons why sherry is the way it is, and we covered this on our two previous sherry episodes, is that it had to be fortified to survive the trip from Jerez in southern Spain to England or to wherever the British Navy was, and just became massively, massively popular. And then, you know, as things that become hugely popular often do, they become watered down and made into product.
I mean, it started out as product, Jamie.
Right, but it started out as something, you know, made intentionally and artfully and then turned into something not that. And
just product.
Right.
I don't need to nitpick you on this. I fully understood what you meant by product.
I know.
I'm just mad at you for pairing this with Paddington and sneaking it by me once again.
He even asked me at the beginning of this miniseries if I had chosen a sherry. And I said, bold-faced, no. And I was not lying.
You just described this as a sherry mere minutes ago.
It's not, though. It's not a sherry. Well, it doesn't carry that DO.
Lie, Jamie? When did you lie? Did you lie just now when you described it as a sherry, thus lying to the audience? Or did you lie weeks ago when you told me that you didn't pick a sherry, lying to me and the audience?
It's okay, Scotty. Get it out. Just get it out of your system. I understand. You're mad. I do. I really do. It's yummy. Okay. Ramiro's a real geek. He gets really, really granular with soil type. When I'm studying, like, Jerez and the soils around Jerez, the big important one to remember is the Albarita, spelled with a Z but pronounced with a lisp, because, you know, Spanish. It's the chalk soil of the region. And then the lesser soils are Barros and Arenas, which are clay and sand soils, respectively. But apparently, I didn't know until I started following COTA 45 that there are some, like, smaller subsets of Albarita soils, some that have, like, a little bit more iron content, some that are just, like, really pure chalky stuff, some that have maybe a hint of clay to hold them together and make them really, really tough and impermeable. And this particular wine, it comes from vines that are on all three of those that I just mentioned. And they all have specific names. This is from Miraflores. Miraflores is not the name of the wine, it's the name of the vineyard. And Miraflores is probably the most important vineyard in Sanlúcar for regular, like, Manzanilla sherry, and then also for this.
Did these folks have, like, one field? Vineyard is the place, the plot of land.
Mm-hmm.
Like a field is a particular hill or something, right?
That you would call that a block.
A block? So yeah. Do they have one block that's on the one soil type and another block that's on... It's not like all three of those soil types are merging together in one place.
No, they're separate blocks. This comes from five different blocks in Miraflores.
And then those are all on different blended soil types, and the chalky and chalky and clay and chalky with iron. Yep. And then they mix that in the butt to make this. With some floor.
That's right.
But with no alcohol added.
Correct.
All right.
You got it.
I know that I understand it.
I'm sad. I knew that this was a swing, and I knew that I had a chance of failure here, and clearly I have failed. But I was really, really hoping you'd like this wine. I love the philosophy behind it. I like the way that it's made.
I can't really detect any philosophy in it, Jamie.
And I really like the wine in the glass. Like, I'm just enjoying every moment sitting here sipping on this wine.
When did your hope turn into despair about the prospects of me enjoying this? Was it after the first wine that I hated this miniseries, or the second wine that I hated this miniseries?
No, my hope was steadfast right up until the moment you stuck your nose in the glass.
Mm-hmm.
and went, ugh, sherry.
You thought you were going to slide this one by me?
No,
I
didn't.
I was going to drink it, and only when you said, oops, all sherry, that I was going to realize, son of a bitch, he tricked me, it's sherry.
I was hoping that you would stick your nose in the glass and think, this smells a little sherry. Bit like sherry, but there are other things here that are intriguing, and then taste it and be charmed by it.
Truly, I think part of my disdain is just inflected by your subterfuge, which I don't appreciate. Then again, in your defense, if you had told me ahead of time that it was a sherry, I probably would have just come into it with my fucking back up against the wall and decided that I didn't like it ahead of time.
Thank you. I appreciate you acknowledging that.
But also, your sneaky son of a bitchery did you no favors this time. Sherry. It's compelling, Jamie. It's compelling. It's interesting. There are notes that I enjoy. Period. Not period. Other negative things about it that we've already discussed.
Right. Yes, for sure. To bring it back around to the movies and maybe talk about the pairing. I don't think I need to make a case that sherry and the region of Jerez is extremely British, despite being in Spain. You're going to argue with me, but I find this wine to be extraordinarily elegant. I think that it is put together really precisely, and it enters your palate. Man, now I've had plenty to drink, and my words are failing me.
Mm-hmm.
But I believe this to be an elegant wine, and that's one of the reasons why I picked it, because you used that word. The philosophy behind it is quite progressive. We're changing the way things are done in Jerez and looking for a way to embrace what is as a result of the British rule and all of that, while also looking farther back to the roots.
Yeah, no, this is a huge, huge strikeout on both movies. Dad, no. No.
You just hate the wine, man. That's not like...
Okay, but I didn't like the wine that you paired with Fury Road, and I ultimately conceded that it was a good pairing with Fury Road.
Okay, that's fair.
In part because it tasted like gasoline.
It doesn't guzzling, taste like
guzzling,
gasoline.
Guzzling. Allowing for your saying that this is an elegant wine, which I don't find anything that's this noxious to be elegance, but it's also not to my taste. Allowing for that... There's nothing in this that reflects all the things that we've been talking about Paddington and about Dora.
That's true.
It doesn't reflect any of the humor or the sweetness or the warmth. If Paddington was like just about Phoenix Buchanan and not about anything else, or if Paddington was like the same story, except minus the bear, the whimsy, and it was just about being imprisoned and like trying to reclaim your humanity.
You just hate this wine.
No, I am describing my experience of the wine, which does not align with my experience of these movies.
That's okay. That's fair.
Do you think it pairs with either one of them? You think it pairs with Paddington?
I do. Yeah. It's got that proper, like, despite being very much of... Like, it is a product of Spain with Spanish attitude. It still is of a piece with the, like, the straight-backed structure that goes along with sherry and that is on display in Paddington, that British attitude.
But you're doing... No, you're...
No,
you're,
I am talking about the wine in the glass, and I know that you have trouble with my metaphors.
This is not a metaphor. This feels like you're talking about your understanding of the context of the wine... And connecting that with the very Britishness of Paddington, in that it's set in England, the characters behave in very English ways, it has a very British sensibility.
Sherry is made for the British palate.
Sure.
And this has a nod to that while still being very much itself.
You're saying that I disagree because I don't like this wine.
Uh-huh.
I counter with, you think it's a good pairing because you do like this
wine.
Well,
that's part of it, for sure.
How do you feel about that? It doesn't pair with Dora.
No, it does not pair with Dora.
No.
It
and
doesn't.
I really don't think it pairs with Paddington.
I think it pairs with Paddington.
There is a burn and a funk and a stank and a bunch of things that are not Paddington.
Also, by the way, pairing for this wine, which we didn't talk about, food pairing.
Oh, yeah, food pairing.
Fish and chips. The kids like fish and chips, right? That's
you
a
know,
thing?
There is a malt vinegar note to this wine that I really hate that I am kind of thinking about now that you mention it.
Such a dick.
Great point.
Over here sipping on Haterade.
Nope.
All
over
day
here
long.
Sipping on fake
delicious,
sherry.
Delicious, delicious sherry.
Adjacent to sherry.
Sherry adjacent wine, yes.
What we haven't been keeping track of, and I don't care at this point because I'm so glad to be out of this miniseries, I guess. No, this has been fun.
This has been a really
this
fun miniseries.
This has been too joyful. I just... I've
You're
only
just
liked,
really mad.
I just only like two of the four wines that you've picked.
Six wines.
Two of the six wines that you've picked.
Also, you miscounted earlier in this episode when you were tallying up the movies. You said that there were 11. There are 13.
I was doing math wrong. I was doing math wrong. Anyway, I don't remember what I was going to say. I don't remember at all.
You're mad.
Oh, yeah. So not that anyone's keeping score, and not that it matters, but I think were we to review the previous six wines, you would definitely have failed on your stated goal of finding background players that for the parents would not be distractions from the kid-friendly food, the parenting of their children, and the watching of these movies. This is not a background player.
No, but Ken Sumoy is.
Disagree.
Lucinda is.
Is that the 1984?
Yeah.
Disagree.
Sure, fine. Kalkari is. The
Paris SP
Balta.
Is not.
The SP is not, and nor is this.
Yeah. So I think...
That's two out of six.
I think three out of six.
Well, I think that you are wrong and dumb. No, you're not wrong and dumb. Your experience is valid, Scott.
This is patronizing. This is patronizing. When the audience doesn't like things, Jamie's sincere about it. And when I don't like things, it's fucking patronizing. Patronizing. I didn't patronize you about the like two movies you didn't like on this show so far, but you fucking patronized me. And you were just as aggressive and whiny about those as I am about this.
That is not true. I was neither aggressive nor whiny. I just didn't like them. Okay, Tenet is a bad movie for dumb people.
I'm doing the interlocking fingers, Tenet, secret hand gesture here.
Yes, but you fucking goad me on at every moment with that fucking movie. And that movie is trash. Hot garbage.
We talk about the self-indulgence of this show, but I'm over here picking movies that I think people might want to watch. And you're out there picking wines that you like.
I think people
care about there was, me, there was let consensus alone what the audience thinks.
At your son's birthday party that the canned sumoy was delicious.
Those people were all drunk and they were glad to have an adult to talk to who didn't have to watch a child.
None of them were drunk at the time.
That's fair. Yeah, I think they were both wrong about the canned sumoy.
Well, put it to a panel of however many people, and, you know, one Scott out of every five normal people dislikes canned sumoy.
I don't know where you got those extra two people from. Also, my point remains that I am trying to pick things for the audience, and you're out here picking things for Jamie. And if I pick shit as weird and as contentious and off the beaten path as the shit you're picking, no one would listen to this show. You can always see it when we pick weird indie stuff that nobody listens.
Yeah, that is fair.
That is fair.
Yep.
Anyway.
Next time on.
No, we're not done yet.
Oh, we've got wife takes out here.
We have wife takes. She's bringing it back. She's got more takes here. For Paddington, she has a question.
Sure.
This is an open-ended question. This is actually for both of us. Which bad behavior from a patron at a restaurant or theater is most deserving of a hard stare?
Ooh, I like this.
This is a good one.
This is a good one.
This is a very good one. Why don't you go first, Jamie? What behaviors?
Oh, this is fully open-ended. Oh, yeah, Jesus.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. What bad behaviors do your restaurant or bar patrons do that warrant a hard stare?
Okay. I know that there are worse ones than this.
But your pet peeve.
The one that just vaulted to the front of my mind is when people try and move their wine glass as you're pouring wine.
People do that like to fuck with you?
No, the instinct is to help.
To make it closer so you don't have to reach as far.
But like,
I'm leads to spilling.
Exactly.
You're already in the act of pouring.
Yep.
It sounds like a prank.
It's so dumb. It's the dumbest thing that people do. And I have, my defense mechanism is to like kind of do a fake pour first.
Yeah. And just wait for them to settle the glass.
Yes.
Man, that is so not helpful. I thought you were going to say the thing where people just like from across the bar hold their glass up.
Well,
in
that
the air.
Shit. Or like snapping.
Ooh, snapping. Snapping is just rude. Snapping to get someone's attention, very rude.
So bad.
Very
so
rude.
Bad. Or the worst of it all, the worst way to get someone's attention in service is to grab them.
Yeah, don't touch people.
The walking through a dining room and it's always
a man. It's always a white man.
Sometimes it is an old white woman too.
Because they think, because they're old grand ladies,
just
that
like
they can do it.
Grabbing onto your forearm, and you're like, oh God, don't do that. Do not do that.
Very rude. Yeah, the other thing, the thing with the glass, that for me, if I were behind the bar, and this is your hard stare.
Right.
But that would be an eye roll for me.
It is.
But the grabbing somebody's arm, that's a fucking hard stare.
That's a hard stare.
That's how you look at someone to remind them that they've forgotten their manners. that's a hard stare for sure.
Okay, theater etiquette. What comes to your mind?
Oh, I mean, the big obvious like contemporary example is like people who are just on their phones in the movie.
Yep.
But the one for me is just people who leave behind a fucking shit show at their seats.
Oh my God, yes.
They go and leave and there's popcorn dumped on the floor, candy boxes left on the floor, soda sticky and spilled all over the floor. Even more egregious are the people who don't even buy your concessions and then leave the shit that they snuck into the theater spilled all over the floor. People who come in with like fucking Thai takeout that stinks up the whole theater, which sounds fucking great, but not everybody else wants to smell that. And then like they leave their like half empty takeout boxes on the floor of the auditorium. Offends me to no end. And the worst offenders are the goddamn rich people.
Yep.
Oh, oh, events that we used to run that would have ticket prices. These would be like for like special events and parties and, you know, fundraiser events with movie screenings. And the ones like the higher the ticket price, the filthier the theater is after.
Mm-hmm. Wasn't there a study lately about like people who have more expensive cars are much more likely to break traffic laws?
I mean, that makes sense because they're entitled fucks.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And you see it. Fucking, how many times have you been cut off by a Tesla?
Oh, that's a good point. Yeah, the concentration of Teslas around here is very
has gotten high.
Yeah.
And they behave badly.
They do behave very badly. Well, because they're learning from their Lord and Savior. All right. Next wife take question.
Yep.
This is a multiple choice question. This one is just for you. Which wine technique or type most resembles homeschooling your kids during their formative years? She does preface this, no right answer. A, Pet Nat. B, biodynamic wine. C, regenerative farming. D, wild yeast fermentation. So I have two things. One, she's been paying very close attention on this show, more so than I have.
Definitely.
Because I remember what many of these things, but like the terms are not immediately available to me. And two, I have my own answers here, but I do want to hear what yours are first. So which wine technique or type most resembles homeschooling your kids during their formative years? Pet Nat, biodynamics, regenerative farming, wild yeast fermentation.
I think it's got to be Pet Nat.
Oh, no way.
Yeah.
It's
got to be.
No, because Pet Nat is just letting your children like live in the forest. And it's just whatever happens, happens. Pet Nat is like the opposite of helicopter parenting. Whereas homeschooling is like there's a protective element to homeschooling. You keep them home because you want to shape them and mold them.
I guess, yeah.
It feels more to me like the biodynamics where like they're because biodynamic is like very, very, they're very interventionist, right? The biodynamic people.
Well, they're not they're regimented in their farming, but they're like no outside influence. Yeah. It's a the farm is a closed system. Nah. Yeah. You're right.
Yeah.
When you're right, you're right.
And I am right.
You were right.
And I'm right about this sherry, too.
No, you're not. You are.
It's not sherry.
It is delicious. Sherry-adjacent wine beverage.
Well, audience, you should share with us your thoughts on the socials, on the DMs, share this episode, share a picture of yourselves watching Paddington 2 or Dora and the Lost City of Gold while drinking this wine, and you and your kids can all make a stinky cat pee face because you don't like the smell of it.
Thank you, everyone, for joining us. It's been a pleasure. I have enjoyed every moment of it.
I have enjoyed my experience with the audience, Jamie.
Please, everyone, follow us on the socials at Bigger Bottle Pod. Go ahead and email us with comments, questions, or concerns at biggerbottlepod@gmail.com. Make sure you rate, review, and follow the show wherever you get your pods, and also tell each and every single one of your friends.
You can also tell them that this episode, as all of our episodes, was produced and edited by Scott Hudson. Hey, that's me. And our social media presence is thanks to Jamie Harrison Rubin.
That's me.
That's him, right over there. You can also tell your friends that our art that you're enjoying is the fine contribution of Ross Connard. Thank you very much, Ross.
Everyone, please remember to drink more wine and watch more movies. It's good for you, we promise.
Good night, everyone.
Goodbye.
Jamie, this was something I was thinking about you specifically as I was watching Dora last night, and this is a real question that I need to pose to you as we wrap things up.
Go on ahead.
Can you say severe neurotoxicity?
Severe neurotoxicity.
Now, can you say it in Spanish?
No.
No.